Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so excited to be able to speak with an outstanding writer by the name of Michael Leahy about his latest book called The Last Innocents, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. I suspect that Michael Leahy had no way of knowing how timely this book would be. He writes about the unrest of the 1960s, which played out, of course, in our nation in so many ways, but particularly along racial lines. And it is a book about the way in which some of that tension and turbulence played out within one of the most successful Major League Baseball teams of the 1960s, namely the Los Angeles Dodgers. And he follows their exploits, particularly through the lives and experiences of seven different players, some of whom are among the greatest legends of the game. And through the ups and downs, we have a sense of the very character of Major League Baseball changing quite dramatically. And again, in ways that most of the people at the time could not possibly foresee in terms of the long-term ramifications, the ways in which Major League Baseball would be changed forever. Michael Leahy might already be familiar to you as the author of Hard Lessons and When Nothing Else Matters, Michael Jordan's Last Comeback. He has done award-winning work for The Washington Post and Washington Post Magazine. Again, this book, an imprint of HarperCollins, is called The Last Innocents. Michael Leahy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks for having me.
Very, very excited about this. Can we touch on the matter of timeliness right off the bat? The fact that, of course, you and I are speaking at a moment in our country's history when it is not by any means the same situation as we saw in the mid-60s, and yet there is a certain tension and a certain kind of ugliness that is with us, a certain kind of pain that is on everybody's minds. What do you see as the most telling parallels between what our country was experiencing now back in the mid-60s and what we are experiencing now?
Well, the two eras share the quality of having been rife with divisions. I think that's historically accurate to say. It for the Dodgers, in for instance, in 1962, the same year that the University of Mississippi was going through the turbulence of integration, the Dodgers faced a myriad of challenges of their own, Greg, that impacted individual players' lives, particularly African-American players' lives. Probably the best, the episode most illustrative of that, Greg, would involve Maury Wills during 1962. Maury was en route to breaking Ty Cobb's single-season stolen base record, and as such was the first African-American player in history to find himself challenging the revered record of a white legend. Given that it was 1962, this would place it a full 12 years, for instance, before Henry Aaron would break Babe Ruth's lifetime home run record. So Wills was a trailblazer in that historic sense. And as he was closing in on Cobb's single-season stolen base record, he began receiving an enormous amount of hate mail from white racists around the country. It was coincidentally, Greg, a period when Sandy Koufax, the immortal left-handed pitcher of the Dodgers, who would go on to become a Hall of Fame pitcher and arguably the greatest pitcher of all time, was receiving hate mail of his own in the form of anti-Semitic letters. And so Maury Wills and Sandy Koufax struck upon a unique idea and what proved to be a winning idea for the two men. And that was they decided they would read each other's mail for a while and sift out the hate mail. The two men were very close, devoted to one another, so that's what they did over the months that followed in 1962. And of course, Greg, being ballplayers, predictably ribbed each other. Ballplayers do nothing without ribbing one another, I've learned during the research for this book. So Maury would say something to Sandy along the lines of, man, you don't want to read this one. And Sandy would respond in kind, Maury, you don't want to go near this letter. But the two men had each other's backs and protected each other. And Maury went on that season to break Ty Cobb's stolen base record and become the National League's most valuable player, and transformed baseball in the process, made base stealing an art form once again. But all these things, Greg, as you rightly pointed out in your question at the top, happened amid the social unrest of the 1960s, which bears eerie parallels to what's going on today. As Wills was inching ever closer to Cobb's record that year and breaking it, the University of Mississippi was racially integrating for the first time. There were riots on campus that required police and troops to come out and quell disorder, reestablish civility and order in Mississippi. And one never knew whether or not violence might be only a step away. And it was a year of political assassinations, of course. A year later, President Kennedy would lose his life. It was the same period when Medgar Evers lost his life. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy would be assassinated later in the decade. So it was a tumultuous time, and African-American players and white players alike had to deal with all that amid all their on-field challenges.
We're speaking with Michael Leahy and talking about his book, The Last Innocents, which examines the Los Angeles Dodgers in the 1960s and explores some of the ways in which Major League Baseball changed so dramatically and how many of those changes seem to be galvanized by events within that particular ball team and in the lives of seven important players in particular. And it is part of the reshaping of Major League Baseball as we have come to know it. Mr. Leahy, in the very first chapter of the book, I'm really glad you take the time to give us some sort of historical backdrop of this moment. In terms of the stature of Major League Baseball at this point, by this I mean the late 1950s as we enter the 1960s, when Major League Baseball had a primacy on the American landscape that it was not going to have for too much longer. Just say a word about the predominance of baseball at that time and the ferocity by which it was followed by its fans.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great question. And indeed, baseball was king in this era. In the era you're talking about, in the 1950s and in the 1960s, the decade that I focus upon, the Super Bowl would not arrive until the late 1960s. And to your younger listeners in particular, Greg, it might come as astonishing to learn that the NBA Finals were not nationally televised in that period. So baseball was king in this era. It was an era when those of us growing up amid it would sneak transistor radios to school during the World Series, because all the World Series games took place during afternoons. So if you were a school kid, the only way you could hear it on radio, since you weren't going to be home to see it on television, would be to sneak your transistor radio into a school. Millions of Americans working at jobs casually strolled away from their jobs for a period, went to taverns or restaurants to watch the games on black and white television. There were often pictures of people in New York and Los Angeles who would line up at around department stores to watch the games on new televisions that department stores were clever enough to put in their display windows. So there was an intensity to viewing the World Series that rivaled what today your listeners would associate with watching the Super Bowl or soccer's World Cup or even the Olympics. And you know, passions ran so high that during the 50s, as I say in the book, during an argument between Yankee fan and a Dodger fan during the 1956 World Series in New York, a Dodger fan went home, returned to a bar, then returned to this bar with a rifle, and shot dead his Yankee fan antagonist, who happened also to be a New York police detective. So the passions were, in instances as like that one, insanely high. And baseball, as you pointed out, Greg, did enjoy a primacy that it didn't today, or that it doesn't today. And that has really nothing to do with what baseball did wrong. It has everything to do with the ascendancy of football and basketball, and with baseball. And I think baseball not only got out of the gate first, but baseball had the great marketing sense in establishing an event that had a magical name, the World Series. There has been no name in sports marketing history, aside from the term Super Bowl, that has been so galvanizing in rousing fans' interest. So baseball enjoyed all of that during the first two-thirds of the 20th century. And today, as your question suggests, obviously occupies a different spot with relation to football and basketball.
Could you also say a word about the significance of the Dodgers changing from the Brooklyn Dodgers to the Los Angeles Dodgers, in effect moving all across the country from the East Coast to the West Coast? What that move meant not only for the ball team, but for Major League Baseball in general?
It was the move that signaled to other cities across the country in the Midwest and the Southwest, or the Midwest, the West, and the Southwest, that the game was changing, that new markets were going to be under consideration, and that this was truly a national game. When the Dodgers arrived in Los Angeles in 1958, this city, which I'm speaking from now, Greg, I'm in Los Angeles right now, this city had not known Major League Baseball. It had a fascination with minor league baseball, the Pacific Coast League. And Los Angeles at the time, in the years prior to the Dodgers' arrival here, enjoyed watching a team called the Hollywood Stars and another team called, a minor league team called the Los Angeles Angels, which were fierce rivals on the order of, say, the Dodgers and Giants or the Yankees and Red Sox. But Major League Baseball was entirely new when it arrived here, and the Dodgers had the good fortune of introducing the game at a time when one of its young play-by-play announcers was about to become a superstar in sports broadcasting annals, and that was Vin Scully. Vin Scully, who would go on to become, obviously, a legend in sports broadcasting, was nothing less than the poet of this game, the bard of the game. And he had a seamless delivery in talking about baseball and human behavior and social events around Los Angeles. He had this incredibly, and still does, melodious voice. And it was to listen to Vin Scully was to listen to the most wonderful narrator in a theater of sorts. And so tens of thousands of Los Angelinos, when they went to ball games, at first the Los Angeles Coliseum, where the Dodgers played from 1958 through their 1961 season, and then in Dodger Stadium, which was opened in 1962 and where the team has played ever since, fans would bring their transistor radios to the ballpark, as I did as a child in the 60s, to listen to Scully. And the ball players at the time would remark that they would play while sometimes hearing Scully describe their feats. It was not uncommon for 20,000 transistor radios to be on at the time. So the Dodgers benefited from all that. Scully made going to a Dodger game a real event. And, of course, it did not hurt that the Dodgers won a World Series title in only their second year in Los Angeles in 1959, and then went on, they became a glamorous team, went on to win World Series in 1963 and 1965, and make it yet again to the World Series in 1966, and had all these glamorous players. You know, they had Sandy Koufax, again, who I mentioned earlier, the immortal left-handed pitcher, and they had Maury Wills, the electrifying base dealer, and Tommy Davis, the National League batting champion, and Wes Parker, the six-time Gold Glove first baseman, and Lou Johnson, who was a Cinderella story and World Series hero in 1965. And the stories go on and on like that. And so celebrities flocked to the game. It was not uncommon for Jack Benny and Milton Berle and Doris Day and others, who were all season ticket holders, to show up at these games. And while Los Angelinos were accustomed to seeing film stars all the time walking around their streets, and it wasn't nearly as big a deal for Los Angelinos to see all these film stars as it would have been for people in other parts of the country to see them, the Dodgers, by contrast, were titanic celebrities in Los Angeles. You know, Sandy Koufax couldn't go anywhere without being mobbed. So the Dodgers became the hottest ticket in town, and so much of that, again, Greg, had to do with Vin Scully's prowess at making these games feel like magical events. They they certainly felt to me as a child like a magical event.
I wanted at some point to touch on this, and I think now is the moment that I want us to just bring in something that is a very wonderful personal connection that you happen to have with this story. It is partly that you yourself as a boy were a rabid fan of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and as a matter of fact, you were even present for one of the most important games in this whole story, and we even have a photograph in the book which helps capture it in a sense from your young perspective. Tell our listeners about that.
It was entirely dumb luck, Greg. I was 12 years old, and the school year had begun in September of 1965 in the Los Angeles City Schools, and a good friend of mine, who was a couple years older, the exotic older woman in my life, had the good sense of bugging her father. She was a 14-year-old, bugging her father to take us all to a game that night. And she asked permission to bring a good friend of hers, another 14-year-old girl, to the game. And her younger brother, a 12-year-old named Kevin Allen, asked their father if he could bring along a friend to the game, and their father said yes, and 12-year-old Kevin Allen called me. So that accounted for why on September 9th, 1965, I found myself in Dodger Stadium, sitting on the third base side in what Dodger Stadium calls the reserve level, which is, I'm counting now, 1, 2, 3, 4 decks up in Dodger Stadium, to see Sandy Koufax take the mound against the Chicago Cubs. And that night, Greg, September 9th of 65, Sandy Koufax would throw his fourth no-hitter and what proved to be his first and only perfect game of his extraordinary career against the Cubs. And if you can believe this, Greg, the game was not televised in either the Los Angeles or Chicago market. And the only film that exists of the game is a couple innings of sort of blurry footage shot by a Dodger employee who was sitting behind home plate of Koufax pitching. And it's almost useless footage, and it's just the first couple innings. So what images still remain of the game are on viewers' mind's eye, including mine. Those viewers who are still alive 51 years later, 29,000 people were in the stadium that night. And as I say in the book, I still have some images of that game on my mind's eye, including a ball that was hit, a line drive that was hit to the Dodgers center fielder, Willie Davis, a ball that was an absolute rope off the bat of a young Cubs outfielder named Byron Brown. And to this day, I can still see the ball moving on kind of a low line to Willie Davis. And ordinarily, such a ball would have been a base hit to center. It would have, the line drive would have sunk in front of the center fielder. But Byron Brown hit the ball so hard that night that it stayed as that, it looked like a taut rope. And it stayed as that rope moving on the same line long enough for Willie Davis to run in from his position in center field and catch the ball on his glove hand side. He was a left-handed outfielder, catch the ball on his left-handed side, and that was the only hard hit ball of the evening against Koufax. One of the other principal characters in my book, Greg, the slick fielding gold glove first baseman Wes Parker, also made a very nice play that night. Maury Wills uncharacteristically made a throw in the dirt on a ground ball that night, uncharacteristically low throw to Wes Parker in the dirt. But Wes Parker was so adept, Greg, at plucking balls out of the dirt that he just plucked this ball out and helped to preserve Koufax's perfect game. So it remains to this day, Greg, an extraordinarily famous moment in Los Angeles sports annals and baseball history. And I feel enormously privileged to have seen it. And yet the man principally responsible for that moment is very shy about it, doesn't like to talk about it. So when I interviewed Sandy Koufax, he didn't want to talk about the perfect game. Hmm. We largely confined our discussion to his close friendship with Maury Wills and Sandy's belief that Maury belongs in the Hall of Fame. And as I say in the book, when I raise the subject of the perfect game, most of my interviews, Greg, were done in person, but Sandy and I spoke over the phone. So when I broached the subject of Sandy's perfect game with Sandy, the phone line went dead.
Well, and we should say, it's not that you said, Mr. Koufax, would you mind if I asked you a question or two about this game? All right. You said to him was, by the way, believe it or not, or I forget exactly how you worded it, but basically right. You said, believe it or not, I was there at that game. You know, he just
right.
bringing it up almost as just kind of an intriguing point of fact and probably harboring the hope that maybe that would cajole him into just speaking even briefly about it. But
right. You have it exactly right, Greg. I was absolutely duplicitous. I was sort of violating the ground rules with Sandy. I thought that if I simply casually mentioned that I had attended the perfect game as a child, that Sandy might open up on the subject. But the next thing I knew, there was just complete silence on the phone line for several uneasy seconds, to the point where I wondered whether the connection might have been dead or gone dead, or whether Sandy might have hung up on me. But Sandy, who's a supremely graceful man, was simply waiting for me to get the message that he just really didn't want to talk about the perfect game. I mean, he is famously reclusive. He was doing me a huge favor in submitting to a telephone interview at all. He had not spoken to other authors who were doing books about the Dodgers, or even him. And so I finally got the message and resumed asking him questions about Maury Wills. And he could not have been either more graceful or more intent on persuading me that Maury belongs in the Hall of Fame. I mean, turning to Maury for a second, Greg, this is a man who, in addition to breaking Cobb's stolen base record, really made base stealing an art form yet again. In the 1950s, the great shortstop of the Chicago White Sox of the time, Louis Aparicio, had won American League stolen base titles while stealing fewer than 30 bases, if you can believe it. Jackie Robinson never stole as many as 50 bases during his heyday for the Dodgers in the 50s. And here was Maury Wills utterly transforming the way people played the game by stealing 104 bases in 1962 and 94 bases in 1965, and paving the way for electrifying base stealers and future Hall of Famers like Lou Brock and Ricky Henderson. So Sandy Koufax, like so many of us, believes that Maury Wills was nothing less than a transformative force in the game, and that Maury was doing all this amid the kind of social challenges to which you referred at the beginning here. You know, Maury would, for instance, Greg, he would, during the Watts riots of 1965, Maury co-owned a dry cleaners that was not far from the riot area in Watts. And there, he and his partner had great concerns that if the riot spread, that their dry cleaners might be consumed by flames like so many other businesses were during that period in the riots in August of 1965. So what Maury did during those hot afternoons in Los Angeles with the rioting a fairly short distance away was stand in front of this dry cleaners to send the signal to anybody who might have a bad idea that this belonged to him and that he and his partner wanted it spared. Well, the rioting did not touch that area. Maury Wills' dry cleaners was spared, but he had this this frightening headache to deal with during afternoons, and then during the nights would go off to Dodger Stadium to play brilliantly in these games.
Wow. Yes, you compare that kind of life to the life of the typical, highly insulated, supremely well-paid professional athlete of today.
Right.
And it places his accomplishments in an entirely different light.
Right. And I think, and right, that's exactly right. And I think that accounts for why so many people close to Maury, Sandy among them, want to see these extraordinary on-field accomplishments that were bracketed by what Maury had to do off the field, rewarded with his selection ultimately to the Hall of Fame. And, you know, Maury was dealing with the same challenges that the other African-American players whom I highlight in this book dealt with. And if white and black ball players were united at the time on any issue, it was particularly the issue of inequitable pay, their lack of bargaining rights at the negotiating table. And the 60s served wonderfully in that regard to boost players' aspirations, black and white, and to move them towards salary equity. The players could look at the time at the change happening all around them in the civil rights movement, in the dissent that sprung from the Vietnam War, and they could say to themselves, look, a change is happening for tens of millions of other Americans in this country. Other Americans are going out to demonstrate about their dissatisfaction with the slow pace of racial integration or with what was going on in Vietnam. Those people are affecting change. Why should we not be able to affect change in their own game?
Right.
And so that sensibility coincided with the tight-fisted ways of baseball's owners and general managers who unwittingly lit the match that led to the fire that created the players' union, which led to some equitable dealings at the negotiating table. And today, of course, has led to these gargantuan salaries.
Right. As you say in the chapter, aptly titled, An Upheaval Begins, this is at by this point we happen to be in the year of 1964, but it speaks to the whole story of your book. By then, only 9 weeks into 1964, change was already the motif of the young decade. It would place added pressure on an array of American institutions, including Major League Baseball, to catch up. We're speaking with Michael Leahy, and we're talking about his book, The Last Innocents, the collision of the turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. It examines the fortunes of the Los Angeles Dodgers, particularly in the early half, the first half of the 1960s, against the backdrop of course, one of the most turbulent decades in American history. One of the names that comes up repeatedly in your book that speaks to this ugly reality of racism is the name Vero Beach. I want you to explain to our listeners, because that's a name that will mean nothing to any of them. It meant nothing to me until I read it in your book. And yet, this is a name that comes up again and again and again, and in many ways comes to represent, in a sense, a very special and very, in a sense, kind of intractable kind of racism with which a lot of the Dodgers had to contend.
All right. Vero Beach was the Dodgers' spring training facility in that era in Florida, and the Dodgers created Dodger Town there. And Dodger Town was an idyllic place. In Dodger Town, black and white players alike lived together in the 50s and 60s. They played golf together when they were not playing on the one of the many baseball fields around there. They swam together, played on pool tables, shot pool together, ate in the cafeteria together. They were brothers in arms. It was a wonderful place. It was kind of an adult's Disneyland. Anything that they might want to do off the field was available to them there. But when they left Dodger Town to go, which sat right in Vero Beach, when they left Dodger Town to go into the rest of Vero Beach, the treatment of black players could not have been more strikingly different. Black players could not go into white movie theaters, could not eat at segregated restaurants in Vero Beach in the early 60s and the 50s. Black players were denied service in laundromats. So it could not have been a more painful experience for many of the black players who encountered segregation in Vero Beach, which some of the black players came to call Zero Beach. Their scorn for Vero Beach was such that some of the black players came to refer to it as Zero Beach. There was one incident in the book that particularly was painful collectively for black ball players, and that involved Lou Johnson, who at the time was a minor leaguer in the Dodgers organization, and who in 1965, while part of the Dodgers spring training team, brought his clothes to a laundromat in Vero Beach and was denied service. And word got back to one of the great sports columnists of the time in the country, the Los Angeles Times, Jim Murray, and he wrote for the first time about Zero Beach. Jim Murray, a white columnist for the Los Angeles Times, exposed the wrongs of Vero Beach. The immortal Dodger catcher of the time, John Roseborough, spoke at length to Murray for that column Murray ran, and that was some of the first. Murray was the first white journalist to train a much needed antiseptic light on the wrongs of Vero Beach. And when Lou Johnson was denied service at that laundromat in 1965, Greg, it was a full 7 months after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 had been passed. The federal statute that barred discrimination at restaurants and hotels and bars and public establishments like laundromats. So it was as if Vero Beach had not gotten the message that Lou Johnson was denied service at that laundromat in 1965. So the book explores those kind of everyday encounters that the Dodgers African-American players had to face in the early and mid-1960s, the kind of treatment that sparked outrage among Dodger players, black and white, because white players were just as furious as black players over the mistreatment of the team's African-American players. The team's players of both races could not have been more united on that point. Mm-hmm.
Another name that figures prominently in the book, not specifically around the issue of racism, at least not in quite so overt a fashion, is the name of Emil Joseph Buzzy Bavetsi.
Bavetsi, yeah.
Bavetsi, who was in the administration of the Los Angeles Dodgers as their general manager, and it fell to him to hammer out contracts and offer salaries to various players. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this. People need to read about it in greater detail in your book. But just say a summary word about the way he conducted this important part of the team's operation and how it ultimately ushered in the new era, which was against everything he stood for, ironically.
Right. Buzzy Bavetsi, the imperious, tight-fisted general manager of the Dodgers in that era, was the chief enforcer of the Dodgers owner, Walter O'Malley, who was equally tight-fisted. Just a sentence of preface, Greg. I think you know these two men ought to be. History ought to record that these two men should be admired for their great strides in helping speed the integration of baseball. Since we referenced that, we've been talking about that for a while. O'Malley and Bavetsi were committed to seeing full integration of the Dodgers. It happened in the 1950s. You could look out at the Dodgers ball club and see a majority black ball club on the field. And you could see that in the 1960s as well. So O'Malley and Bavetsi need to be heralded for all that. But with regard to salary negotiations, the two men could not have been more tight-fisted. Buzzy Bavetsi, Greg, was infamously would sometimes seek to deceive players during salary negotiations by placing, if you can believe this, Greg, phony contracts on his desk that would have salary figures of other players on the contract. So if a player like Ron Fairley, the Dodgers right fielder, walked in, he would see the contract of Tommy Davis, the Dodgers star left fielder, on Bavetsi's desk with a phony salary figure on it, a figure much lower than Bavetsi was actually paying Tommy Davis. And Bavetsi would excuse himself from the room, knowing that temptation would take over and that Fairley, who was alone in the room by now, would peer onto Bavetsi's desk to see what Bavetsi was supposedly paying Tommy Davis. And that's indeed what Pavese did to Ron Fairley 1 year. Pavese excused himself, left the room. Fairley looked at this bogus contract on Pavese's desk, saw what looked to be what Tommy Davis was earning, and it was the very figure Fairley had thought of asking for. But Fairley looked at the figure and thought, my gosh, I don't deserve what Tommy Davis is getting. I can't possibly ask for that. So Pavese got exactly what he wanted. When he returned to his office, Fairley, having seen what Davis was making, lowered his own salary demand by $10,000 to $15,000. So it was that kind of duplicity that ultimately got Pavese in a jam, because he bragged about what he had done to Fairley without citing Fairley by name. He bragged about what he had done to Fairley to Sports Illustrated magazine and to other publications. And he bragged about similar tactics he had employed during salary negotiations with other players.
And again, this is years later he's boasting about this. But at the time, this was all absolutely secret.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And the furor that was sparked by Pavese's disclosure of his tactics, the furor sparked in the aftermath of stories that ran in places like Sports Illustrated and the Los Angeles Times and other esteemed publications, helped again to generate the kind of heat that led to the eruption that gave rise to the Players Union and ultimately the kind of salary equity that would give players much greater salaries, fairer salaries, and, of course, bedevil O'Malley and Buzzy Pavese.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think is hard to understand is here's how you spell it out in as you describe what it was like in that period then after the Dodgers win the World Series and their star players begin renegotiating their contract. I mean, because each of them only had a year contract. Nobody back then had such a thing as a multi-year contract at all. So this gauntlet was run again and again. And you're saying here that Wills, Koufax, Drysdale, and others had stardom, whatever that meant, but they had no clout and certainly no financial security, either in Bavese's office or with anyone else. As players, they were hired help. Glamorous and highly sought after help, perhaps, but help just the same. Always subject to wealthy and powerful men's orders, and always dependent on their blessing and their money, most of all. I think it's really hard for us to imagine such a scenario, because now we think of the typical baseball star having, I mean, kind of an obscene amount of clout, just nothing to say nothing of an obscene amount of money. And it's just strange to think about a different world of Major League Baseball in which a baseball player could be a star and yet have so little control over their destiny and over what they would be paid.
Mm-hmm. And principally responsible for that, Greg, was the reserve clause. The onerous reserve clause, which bound a player to a team, and he couldn't leave that team unless he either retired from the game or he was traded away by the team. So the reserve clause gave owners and general managers essentially dictatorial control, and the only avenue that a player had to resist that control was to, on his own, conduct a salary holdout, to say, I'm not going to play the next season unless you pay me what I believe I deserve. But even then, the owners and the general managers could say, look, we're paying you X amount of dollars, and in the end, you're either going to sign the contract or you're not going to be playing next season. And because of the reserve clause, they wouldn't be able to go anywhere else. That that situation really was the status quo for the Dodgers until early in 1966, before the 66 season had begun.
That's Michael Leahy talking about his book, The Last Innocents, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. Tomorrow on the morning show, you will hear part two of my conversation.